We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
An active mic here for Maria.
Thank you.
And welcome back. How was it being stuck in Paris for 5 days?
What?
You just made somehow, stuff up while you were gone.
You weren't here last week, so I figured you were in Paris or someplace.
No, somehow I missed the whole Paris part.
You should get out of your hotel room more often.
All right, let's start out with local. And Monday there was a city council vote on panhandling.
Yeah, the panhandling bill, a bill that was being heavily pushed by Tim Burgess, the sort of law and order man on the city council. It looked like it was going to pass overwhelmingly, and then some community groups and folks got together and lobbied certain city council members, and some of them changed their votes.
Yeah, and listeners to this show, by the way, because we were encouraging people last week while you were in Paris, to call up and lobby city council people, and you know a lot of other groups were doing this too, but we shouldn't probably take full credit, but we will because you know we're modest. So good job, listeners. They thought a couple weeks ago it was going to be an 8-1 vote. McGinn came out at the end of last week and said that if the vote were close, he would go ahead and veto it. And the vote wound up being 5-4. Six votes are needed to override a veto. And so yesterday he went ahead and he vetoed it.
Yeah, and so it looks like the city council, of course, the city council has 30 days to try to get six votes together to override the veto. But that won't be an easy task.
And the Downtown Seattle Association, which was the big business trade group that has been the primary mover behind this, because let's face it, it's a lot easier to scapegoat the poor than it is to, you know, improve traffic or make parking cheaper downtown, is pushing very, very hard against council members in order to get this passed, primarily for the PR boon of, you know, people in the suburbs hearing, oh, well, they won't have those horrible beggars on the streets now. It's safe to go back down to Macy's. It really is remarkable how people are willing to scapegoat human beings like this for the sake of you know the perceived value of possibly making a buck. But that was the dynamic in play here, and a lot of the opponents of the bill making the case that this was going to be counterproductive. It was not a necessary bill in terms of the behavior being prescribed already being illegal under city law. It would just give police more excuses to rouse the homeless, basically, or people whose looks they didn't like, or people who or the sight of whom was unsettling to suburban shoppers. And McGinn, to his tremendous credit, vetoed the bill. And so the council members who voted against, the four council members, Licata and O'Brien, and I believe it was Rasmussen and Harrell were the other two, deserve our thanks. They deserve a reminder also that when the effort to override the veto comes up, that those no votes need to hold firm.
Yeah, and I want to say thank you to all the people who made the good case, the very good case, that if this bill passed and was not vetoed, that it would place an unfair burden on the poor and homeless who wouldn't have the means or the ability to challenge citations in court. You know, it's not possible, simply not possible for a homeless person to pay the $50 fine, not possible for a homeless person to pay an attorney or to go to court or to even receive a court summons when you don't have a permanent address. So they made the very good case that after given a citation under the law that the homeless and that many poor people would not have any means of redress.
Yeah, it would just get them into the legal system, which in turn means it would make them less eligible.
It would criminalize the poor.
It would make them less eligible for benefits, less eligible for housing, potentially jobs, and so forth. Mm-hmm. And in cities, particularly San Francisco, where this has happened before, this is exactly what has happened. It's exactly the arc that such laws have followed. And the four council members and Mayor McGinn, to their credit, didn't buy the hype.
That's right.
All right. Moving on to Seattle's Parks Chief.
Yeah, it came out this week that Seattle Parks Chief Tim Gallagher, after hearing from Mayor Mike McGinn that all city departments were supposed to cut their budgets for between 1.5 and 3%. Seattle Parks Chief Tim Gallagher just said, oh, the heck with that, and I'm just going to go take a few trips on the taxpayer dime. Turns out in March he was out of the office pretty much the whole month, traveling to Washington, D.C., Atlanta, and Palm Springs, spending over $4,000 in taxpayer money to do that. And then in April...
times are tough all over.
And then in April, he and his Recreation Division Director, Sue Goodwin, took off to Australia and spent about $6,000 of taxpayer money on a trip there. And he still hasn't returned to work in April. Eventually, when he does, I hope Mayor McGinn...
Isn't it almost May?
Yeah, well, it is almost May. I hope Mayor McGinn takes him aside and said, buddy, you're fired, you know?
And if you want time to go play on the beach, here's all the time you need.
Yes. Unfortunately, you're going to have to pay out of your own pocket for that.
All right. Moving on to an initiative that was rolled out this week, 1077.
Yeah, Initiative 1077, which was announced with much fanfare, and of course the media said, gosh, look at this, a pro-tax initiative being rolled out by Bill Gates' dad, which I thought was kind of funny, given that Bill Gates' dad had been on a commission that was studying the state's tax structure a few years back, and that commission recommended that Washington State initiate a state income tax all the other states in the union.
Yeah, he's been on the forefront of this issue for a number of years. So this is no
this
surprise.
Is not a new thing for him. But I-1077 would impose an income tax on high earners in the state of Washington. It'd be a 5% tax on single people earning over $200,000 or couples earning over $400,000 a year. And a 9% tax on those single people who make over $500,000 and couples who make over $1 million. And proponents of the initiative say that would be about 3%, the upper 3% of earners in the state of Washington would be subject to that tax. And that that's one side of the initiative, which would impose the tax on high earners. The other side of the initiative would provide tax relief. It's that part of the initiative that I find to be extremely controversial. The tax relief that's proposed would reduce property taxes by 20%, and it would exempt a number of small businesses from paying the B&O tax. The problem is that the number of businesses that would get tax relief under this initiative is about 90% of the business community in the state of Washington. But it does not. But the initiative itself does not provide any sales tax relief. So what you're doing is you're going to impose a tax on high income folks in the state of Washington, but you're going to provide tax relief to 90% of businesses and not to folks who really need it, the poor and people who have to pay a high burden of sales tax.
Yeah, what's really interesting about this is that the primary criticism of Washington State's tax structure, of course, and it's one that Gates himself has made many times, is how regressive it is. That is, that poor people pay a much higher percentage of their income in the Washington state taxes than the wealthy do. And this would partially redress that by having the wealthy pay more. But it is a measure that is designed to succeed at the polls. And the way it succeeds at the polls is by appealing to the middle and upper middle class and to the political and media class in this state that form opinions. And it's doing that by focusing on property tax relief and on the B&O tax rather than on the sales tax, which is the most regressive element of the tax structure, and which, you know, our sales tax, when you add on particularly city and county taxes as well, is among the highest in the country right here, and it would seem to be an obvious candidate for tax relief. But that being said, you know, they do deserve credit for rolling it out, and particularly when the political wisdom in this state, particularly at the legislative level, for years has been, oh, a measure like this would never pass constitutional muster, and it would never be approved by the public. Well, a King 5 Survey USA poll out this week shows that not only do voters currently, anyway, approve of the concept of 1077 by a 66-27 measure, but every single demographic that is measured approves of it. It's actually more popular in eastern than western Washington, 66% to 63%. 57% of Republicans support it. Every demographic supports this, so it's very likely to pass, I would think.
Yes, the tax on the wealthy is very popular. When you couple it with the tax relief for business, it's surprisingly popular in the conservative demographic, which I think is the main, as you said, the main reason why they propose business tax relief rather than sales tax relief.
Yeah. The other sort of interesting side note of this is that the champion of the taxpayers, Tim Iman, who has been making rhetoric for 10 years about how high property taxes are and how you know, taxpayers need relief from this. He kind of showed his two stripes this week because he, of course, is adamantly opposed to 1077, because while it is tax relief, it's not his idea of tax relief because, as with many Republicans, once you strip away the populist rhetoric, in his case, it's all about, rolling back the size of government by starving all revenue and B, in particular, protecting the interests of the wealthy. And, that's always been Iman's gig, and it was, never more apparent than this week.
All right. Moving on. Money Tree. Talk about Money Tree.
Yeah, Money Tree, they are the obnoxious commercials and predatory 391% annual loan rates, have been fighting really hard over the past few years here, as with payday lenders around the country, to try and beat back and skirt regulations being imposed by different states on their business, because predatory lending, as the name implies, preys on people. It's a real social problem in terms of the way these loans are actually used and the kind of debt that people can rack up very, very quickly. It's legalized loan sharking, basically. And a couple of years ago, the Washington State Legislature passed a very watered-down version of regulations on the industry that were opposed by Margarita Prentice and some of the other paid and bought for legislators that the payday loan industry has purchased over the years. But one of the reforms that was put into place was that people cannot make more than 8 loans a year from one of these companies. And the idea behind this is that because the annual rates for the loans are so high that you don't want people making permanent long-term loans. You want these to be loans that that really do get paid off in 15 days or whenever the next paycheck comes around. What happened this week was that the Washington State Department of Financial Institutions issued a cease and desist order to Money Tree. The state nailed them, basically, with a finding of fact that Money Tree has been systematically trying to evade this law by going to customers, flagging them when they get up to 7 loans and saying, okay, retroactively, we're going to bundle all of these, count them as one loans, and delete from our database any evidence that the previous loans ever took place, and that way you can get 7 more loans from us this year.
This is called fraud.
Yeah, this is called fraud. And so at this point, if Money Tree doesn't comply, the DFI can seek an injunction in Superior Court and ultimately seize possession of their property if they don't continue to apply. So Money Tree, once again, showing their true colors, popped for it. And it was very interesting that this story got almost no play in local media whatsoever because, surprise, surprise, Money Tree is a very aggressive advertiser with many of the same media outlets who would normally report on something like this.
Yeah.
All right. Well, speaking of stuff that doesn't get covered, Microsoft had some news about them that wasn't picked up by the local media.
Yeah, and funny thing, because you would think that Microsoft, big local story and so forth. Well, no, the Washington State Legislature took a bit of a break this week from its trying to figure out how it was going to bridge its $2.8 billion shortfall to give Microsoft a huge new tax break. A couple of them, actually. One is that they redefined what constitutes a royalty for a royalty tax so that businesses like Microsoft, in fact, it's almost specifically a bill that's tailored by the Senate Finance Chair, Ross Hunter, a 17-year veteran of Microsoft employment. It's almost specifically tailored to meet the needs of Microsoft, so that they only have to pay royalties on sales within Washington State, which of course is a very small fraction of their global total of sales. That's a tax break worth about $100 million a year to Microsoft, money that will no longer go into the state treasury. Beyond that, they also got exemption for a tax dodge that they've been employing for a number of years, wherein they package their software in a shell operation in Nevada, even though it's all actually packaged, you know, their corporate headquarters for that division was separated out and put in Reno, even though they actually have a handful of employees in Nevada, and almost all of the actual work is done out in Redmond. That tax dodge, because Nevada doesn't have any particular taxes on this, has saved Microsoft something like $1.2 billion over the past number of years. And retroactively over the last 13 years, the state legislature also went and granted Microsoft an exemption for that as well. So when you hear that there are just no easy solutions to the state's budget shortfall right now, and we're cutting everything we can, and it's cut right down to the bone, don't believe it for a second, because the lucrative tax breaks, particularly for big companies like Microsoft and Boeing, just continue on and on and on, and both parties do it, and it's there seems to be no end in sight.
All right, and then finally on Local Briefly, Peter Holmes petitioning the Supreme Court.
Yeah, City Attorney Peter Holmes has now weighed in because we already had the federal and state governments involved in Rob McKenna's lawsuit, or his actual joining of a lawsuit by, it was 10, and now after Alaska has joined in, 11 other Republican state attorneys general having sued the federal government last month to prevent implementation of Obama's health care reform bill that Congress passed and Obama signed. We've talked on this show before how that bill really is basically a political gesture that has no real legal legs to stand on. Not to mention that it's not representative of the sentiments of a solid majority, both of Washington State's elected federal officials and the actual polled opinions of Washington State residents. McKenna is doing it for his own for his own political ambitions. Basically, he wants to short a Republican base so he can run for governor in 2012. Well, the city attorney, Peter Holmes, has filed with the Washington State Supreme Court petition with them this week to force McKenna to withdraw from the health care reform lawsuit on the grounds that he has exceeded his authority as state attorney general and without the permission of the legislature and or the governor, both of whom opposed his move, that but he simply didn't have authority to join that lawsuit. So now here we have McKenna using his state time in order to join this lawsuit. Christine Gregoire, who opposes what McKenna has done, having to hire outside counsel because if she were trying to fight this lawsuit, she would have to have McKenna represent her, and she obviously can't do that. So she's having to charge taxpayers for outside legal help. Now you have the city of Seattle's city attorney weighing in on this. So the next time you hear Republicans talk about government waste and how much money is being spent by corrupt officials on things that are a waste of taxpayer money, just remember how much money at every level of government Rob McKenna is wasting in order to make this political gesture.
Yeah, we come to find out now what the Republicans think government is good for.
All right. Moving on to national and
legal fees.
Yes.
And Texas has "Don't mess with Texas." I don't know what Arizona's motto is, but
Don't have conventions here.
Yeah.
folks may remember way back in the day when there was a very successful boycott campaign in the state of Arizona around its rescission of the Martin Luther King federal holiday, mm-hmm. And they eventually had to pull back from that after losing a ton of convention business over a period of several years, including, I believe, the Super Bowl at one point. That was supposed to be originally held in Phoenix. Well, it may be about time for that kind of a boycott again this week, because the legislature of the state of Arizona and yesterday the governor of the state of Arizona pretty much lost their collective minds. Arizona stating into signing into law the Latino Harassment Act of 2010, otherwise known as a very stringent anti-immigrant law that basically gives police carte blanche to detain on quote-unquote probable cause anybody that they think might look like an illegal alien. Now, how you judge by appearance whether a person is an illegal alien, since most of them aren't going to be driving around in cars with Sonora license plates, it is basically, well, they look Latino. And this isn't, pretty obvious invitation to racial profiling, and a lot of, immigrant and immigrant rights and Latino support groups in Arizona and around the country are up in arms about this, civil disobedience and direct actions happening, et cetera. The Arizona House this week also voting to require presidential candidates who want to appear on Arizona's ballot in the future to prove their eligibility for the presidency by producing a birth certificate. So, at some point you just can't make this stuff up. It just is really getting kind of ridiculous, and, you know, at some point, the adults in the room, and particularly in our national and local media, need to be pointing out that this is grossly irresponsible behavior. It's not just a question of, well, some people agree with this and some people don't agree with this. This is just it's frightening. It's frightening, and it is abuse of power in almost every conceivable way.
All right. Moving on, another disaster this week at one of our energy facilities down in Gulf of Mexico?
Oh, yes. There was a fire, an explosion, and then another explosion, and an oil rig sank off the...
And a volcanic eruption.
Well, we're not talking about the volcanic eruption. We're talking about
in the
oil
Gulf of Mexico.
Well, that's not necessarily, that's not that funny, because often when there's a disaster in an oil rig, there's always the question of what's going to happen to the oil that's bubbling up out of the ground. And as it stands right now, nobody's quite certain if the oil load that this rig was drilling into is going to stay in the ground or not, now that the rig itself has collapsed and sunk off the coast of the Gulf of Mexico. And what's kind of interesting too is when I was reading about this, I noticed that I came across a statistic of 500 fires on platforms in the Gulf of Mexico since 2006, which means it's not unusual for there to be a fire on an oil rig. What's unusual is to have it happen so frequently, about one a week in the last 4 years. It begs the question of how much regulation is there really of the oil industry. And although the oil industry, like the coal industry, likes to pretend that things are a lot safer and big accidents don't happen anymore, that's all in the past, et cetera, that's simply not true, as we saw this week.
All right.
And yeah, I many years ago actually had a job in Houston teaching continuing education in industrial hygiene in some of these petrochemical facilities, and you literally have to teach people not to lick the walls on the side of the tanks. I mean, the awareness of safety that the companies promote is very, very poor. When you have, as Maria says, real environmental exposures with some of these things, it's not just a question of loss of life. It's also a question of a real potential for fouling the Gulf of Mexico and anywhere else that there is offshore drilling, which, as we know, the Obama administration is now going to be much more extensive.
All right. This week's economic news.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about the case that the SEC is bringing against Goldman Sachs. It alleges that Goldman Sachs traders set up an investment vehicle called Abacus 2007-AC1, that investment vehicle was meant to fail, and that they were going to try to sell the shares in that vehicle off to their customers. And at the same time as they were setting up this vehicle, they got this major hedge fund manager, John Paulson, to pick which securities would go into Abacus. But it turns out Paulson at the same time was making bets against the Abacus investment that he was buying a product that would pay him off if Abacus failed at the exact same time that he was picking what investments would go into Abacus. Essentially, yes, he was setting it up to fail because he was going to make out like a bandit if it did. So this is clearly a conflict of interest. The question, of course, is did Goldman Sachs break any laws by doing this? Goldman Sachs says, oh, no, we weren't breaking any laws. This was all perfectly legal. We sold the product to very sophisticated investors. That is, they sold it to other banks. They gave those investors a complete list of what investments were in the Abacus investment vehicle. But even though they didn't tell people that the guy who was picking the investments to go into Abacus was making bets on it to fail, they say, oh, that wasn't required by law. That we didn't have to tell the investors who was actually selecting the investments to go into it. The SEC's argument, however, is you don't just follow the letter of the law in these things. There are certain responsibilities that as an investment bank you have to your customers, and that includes paying attention to the actual construction of a specific investment. The construction or the context in which it's set up is equally important.
Did you say responsibilities to investors?
Yeah, that's the whole line of argument now in regulating financial reform, is that yes, if you're going to play the role of an investment bank, you do have some responsibilities. Your main responsibility is not just to make money for you and your own shareholders. You have a certain amount of responsibility to your clients as well. Those are the two main arguments the SEC is making. First, the responsibility of the investment bank. Secondly, the construction or the context in which you set up an investment is also important, your intentions for that investment, and you have to let your investors know what those are.
I can see the response of the Goldman Sachs people to that being incredulous.
What do you
mean responsibility?
Yeah, and our responsibility is to make money. That's clearly what their intent is, and they're going to argue that in court. And Goldman Sachs is a company that is very aggressive in the legal arena, and they have a lot of financial resources to take this to court and make it drag on for years and years and years. So we'll see. And if Obama is not reelected, you know, in 2 years, if a Republican president continues the lawsuit, we'll see.
All right. Briefly, Iraq, the Baghdad prison there.
Yeah, it turns out that Nouri al-Maliki has his own militia. It's called, let's see here, it's called the Baghdad Brigade, and they're not under the military, and they're not answerable to the police. And they were running their own prison in the north of Baghdad, where between 200 and 400 detainees, nearly all of them Sunni Muslims, were held, and many of them tortured. And Nouri al-Maliki claims to not know anything about this. However, he is the commander-in-chief of this militia, who, as I said, does not answer to the Department of Justice, and who was disappearing detainees into this prison for obviously political reasons.
And given that the United States itself had a hand in setting up the death squads that were running rampant a couple, 3 years ago, the chances that the United States wasn't aware of this prison are also not very high.
All right, events.
A couple of them coming up today from 9 to 5 o'clock. Karen Armstrong is one of several speakers at Compassionate Seattle Showcase and Exchange. There will also be a performance tonight from 5 to 7:30. That's at the Center for Spiritual Living, 5801 Sandpoint Way Northeast. Also today, down in Tacoma, Colonel Ann Wright back in the region. She'll be at Coffee Strong, the GI Coffee House outside Fort Lewis, at 11 o'clock this morning. And then at 2 o'clock at King's Books in Tacoma at 218 St. Helens Avenue. And on Thursday, the 29th, this coming up, is Dining Out for Life. Scores of local residents will be donating a portion of their proceeds to Lifelong AIDS Alliance. So get out and have a meal and help a good cause on Thursday.
All right. And there's also the War on Global Health Conference happening at the Hub Auditorium, University of Washington, both today and tomorrow. Talking as we do every week with John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk. And what do people find with Eat the State?
people find Java Maria behind a microphone on Saturday morning?
If they can get through the door. Where do people find Eat the State?
It comes out every couple of weeks where you find free publications, bookstores, coffee houses, King County Library System, and on the web, of course, at www.eatthestate.org. If you have questions, comments, tips, good restaurants in Paris for the next time Maria goes there, it's email us at info@eatthestate.org.